Hello, and welcome to episode 54 of Shelf Love, the podcast that has fun taking romance novels seriously. Guests lend their expertise to help me explore identity, relationships, and romance as a genre. I'm Andrea Martucci, host of the Shelf Love podcast, and today I am once again joined by Tasha L. Harrison, romance author, editor, and lady about Twitter. You can hear part one of our conversation in episode 53, and I definitely recommend taking a listen if you haven't already, because they go together like an oyster fork and oysters. That reference will be funny later. Please hold your laughter. In episode 53, we got into why Amazon's algorithm is racist, the pervasive white gaze of publishing, and what you can do to be an anti-racist romance reader. In this episode, 54, we talk about A Romance Worth Reading, A Duke by Default by Alyssa Cole. Our conversation is far-ranging. Friends who aren't friends, parents who suck, figuring out how your brain works, and the horse your man smells like. Enjoy! So, Tasha, the romance worth reading that you wanted to talk about was A Duke by Default, part of the Reluctant Royals series by Alyssa Cole. Why do you think this is a romance worth reading?
Mostly I think it's a romance worth reading because I enjoy modern royalty tales. I don't really care for historical romance. Not supposed to say that, I know. But like, I don't really like those, you know, the many million dukes friggin' stories. Mm-hmm. And I was really interested when she was telling me about Princess in Theory. I was really interested in that twist that she put on it. So, you know, I've read that story, and then this character, Portia Hobbs, was presented as like this trash human being in the previous one, like someone who was just like messy and a drunkard, and like you're giving this person a book? Okay. But yeah, it's really just a Cinderella story at its core, you know, like of a bratty, spoiled American girl and like a surly, swashbuckling, I mean, like literally. Mm-hmm. Like he makes swords, you know, like a surly guy, like a grumpy one, sunshine one. Like it had all of the things that I really loved about romance. And then, of course, I just love Alyssa Cole, period. Point blank. Huge fan.
So what is this book about? What happens?
This book really is about it's a personal journey. Like it's an internal journey, mostly for Portia to figure out why she is the way she is, how her brain works, and to stop holding on to the negative input that she's had from people because of the mistakes she's made based on the way that her brain works. And there's like a lot of vulnerability in there. Some of that stuff is really uncomfortable to read, you know, and mostly because I connected with it. And I was just like, oh, especially when she was talking to her parents and they would say one thing and then she would dissect it another way. I'm like, holy shit, I do that all the time. Mm-hmm. Like you think you're reading between the lines, but you're really just, this is the story you're telling yourself. Like Brene Brown says, the story I'm telling myself is that I'm a shit person. You know what I mean? When you had that kind of negative input your whole life, it's really hard to get away from. And I think that's pretty much what this whole book was about. Just her realizing that, yes, my brain works differently. And this is why things have mapped out the way they have in my life.
Right. When we start A Duke by Default, Portia has Project New Portia, in which she has resolved she's going to do things differently because she has made a mess of her life and she's starting over. Mm-hmm. She is going to leave her home in New York City and become the apprentice of a sword maker in Scotland. And
like, how fucking random. And you know what? Yeah. That's like once you start reading the book and you realize that she's ADD, that first thing is like so hugely impulsive. This is ADD. Mm-hmm. Even like, oh, I'm going to fix my life. I need a huge change. I'm moving to Scotland. Or you could just stay home. You know, you can change at home. It's fine. You know? Oh, God. Like, there were so many pinpoints.
So, Tavish.
Tavish McKenzie.
Tavish McKenzie is a sexy Scot. He's a silver fox. He's only like late 30s, but he has a little bit of silver in his hair.
I don't know who I kept imagining him as, like an Eric Bana with like the silver in his sideburns.
I feel like the cover and the way he's described very much reinforce that.
Mm-hmm.
So he's surly. He's the grumpy one. she comes in and she's like, I'm going to fix everything. Like, they don't have social media. I'm going to do this. Like, she is just overhauling everything and making it better. And they, of course, fall in love because it is a romance novel.
It is.
And she happens to discover that he is, in fact, a duke. And he has had his birthright withheld from him through various secrets, various people's secrets. And
random secrets.
Yeah. And so then she basically becomes like his squire and is trying to help him navigate this new world. And Tavish is trying to figure out how to navigate the new world and maintain what's important to him. Like, he is very involved in the community, and his mother was an immigrant to Scotland from Chile. So his brother Jamie is also a person of color. And so he is like very aware, because of his own family's experiences, about the anti-immigration feelings in Scotland and the way his brother has been treated differently because of his skin color. And so he's like very dedicated to trying to make the world a better place in these ways. And so his struggle is kind of like, how do I use my new power as like a duke to...
How do I use my white privilege for good?
Exactly.
I mean, when it really boils down to it, like, the story has lots of like, it's like little thin cake layers, but like that one layer seems so easy to me. You know, like, he knew who he was. He knew exactly who he was. And it was a good opposition to Portia, who knew absolutely nothing about who she was, or thought she knew nothing, you know. Mm-hmm. So they were always clashing up against this, and he could see her for who she was, that she was this, you know, powerhouse of a person who could figure out anything, especially things that he didn't want to figure out, you know. Mm-hmm. But she saw him, like, all his whole life, he pretty much was this person, you know. So she comes in and she's like, I'm going to wreck everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is like kind of how I feel about everything. Every time I approach them, I'm like, gingerly, don't wreck this.
And so, right, so over the course of the story, Portia basically, through watching these videos, self-diagnoses ADD, and then does eventually start working with a therapist. But, you know, one of the things you wanted to talk about, you have ADD?
I do have ADD. And I was a late diagnosis. I was like 38 and 42 now before I'd been diagnosed. But it presents differently in women, mostly. Mm-hmm. I was never a bad student because I had figured out my own routines and ways to do things to make sure that I was, you know, excelling academically. But I've always had like that churning mind, unable to slow down, overthinking things. And when you have ADD, it can trigger anxiety because you're always worried about doing things wrong. And there's no real evidence that, like, is this a chemical thing or is this just the way that your brain is wired? But over time, it just becomes how you react to things. And then as I got older, it just felt like it became even harder, you know, like there's just so many moving parts. My ADD always gets really triggered when it's things that I can't control, you know, like I'm always trying to control all the little things around the one thing I can't control, and one thing falls. And then I'm like, OK, I can't sleep for a week because I need to figure this out. And, you know, I was going through that for probably like 4 or 5 years. And a close friend of mine was like, you know, she was having some of the same problems, and she was like, you know, I'm going to go talk to a psychiatrist and see what they say, which I've always had a therapist, not a psychiatrist. So she went to a psychiatrist and they were like, yeah, you're ADD. And then she was like, yeah, this is the checklist she gave me. And she sent it to me. And I was like, so I'm ADD. Like, everything, this is like on the checklist, I was. And it was a realization. It's me and my friend Katie, we talk about it. It's like there's this period of mourning because you kind of think, like, who would I have been if I had been diagnosed earlier? You know, like, and I kept thinking that when I was reading Duke by Default, because Portia would start so many things and she would never finish them because she would lose interest, or, you know, she would feel like she wasn't good at it, so she would just drop it. I was like, you know, well, if I had been diagnosed earlier, like, what kind of writer could I have been? Like, who would I have been by now if I could have been able to focus easier than I was always able to? Like, Pomodoro method was invented for me because Tasha can't stay focused more than in like 25 minutes to start off a task. Like, once I get into it, I can focus. But like, if I'm just sitting down to do something, I will dilly-dally for hours and then get mad at myself because I've wasted time. But yeah, like it just, like I get upset sometimes about it. It's like, why didn't my mom try to get me diagnosed? And because I grew up in the shut up and study. You know what I mean? Shut up and study. Figure it out. I can't, my brain is not working around this. I don't know how to do this. Figure it out. Figure it out. So I figured it out. And the funny thing about that was too, is like when I told my mom that I've been diagnosed and I was explaining to her the checklist of things, she was like, oh, that's what ADD is? She's like, well, hell, I'm ADD. See? It's like, I feel like there's a lot of stigma around it because I feel like maybe it's environmental, like we're getting too much input and that's why our brains are jacked up now. And some of us can slow down and process and some of us can't. And I'm one of those that can't. Like, I'm always taking in input. Always. And even I feel like sometimes I'm taking it in when I'm sleeping and I probably shouldn't sleep with my TV on, but that's a whole other thing, you know, but like, I feel like I'm always getting input and the trials that she went through, like just discovering that she was ADD and like feeling relief and then also kind of upset and, you know, still feeling like, yeah, now I have this, but what do I do now? It's all very relatable.
You know, as you were talking, and then you were like, and then the book, and I was like, oh, right, we're talking about the book. But as you were saying all that, I was like, I seriously am sitting here thinking, I'm like, do I have ADD? Like,
you know what? We kind of had that same kind of conversation with Alyssa. Like, she was talking about writing the book, and then she was talking about how Bree has sent her all those videos.
Yeah.
And at this point, she was still trying to suss out if she was ADD or not. And me and my friend were talking to her. I was like, yeah, you're basically ADD. He's like, we did this. We've been here. Like, we just did this last year. We've been where you are. And it's so much easier once you figure it out, because then you know where to look for ways to work with it versus always feeling like you're trying to work according to how everyone else does things. You know, like everybody gets up, works a 9 to 5, you work 8 hours and then you get up and like, no, I my body doesn't work that way. My brain doesn't work that way. I work in 2 hour spurts. Then I got to do something else. You know?
Well, that's something that Portia talks about, thinks about in the book, about how she's like, well, right. Like, now that I have a name for it, I understand it's not a failing in me per se. It's my brain works differently and I just need to work with my brain. And now that I have language around it, now that I kind of have tips that are for my brain and not everybody else's brain, I can be more productive about it. And because, like, as you were saying that, I was like, well, I wonder, you're talking about how women, like, their ADD symptoms may present themselves differently than, like, let's say a man. And I was thinking about, like, Asperger's. And that's something that Helen Huang talks about in The Kiss Quotient. About how, you know, Asperger's and autism often looks different in women compared to men because of socialization. You know, it looks a little bit different because the point of all of it is like, how are you going to react to it? And like, so I think women in particular react to social stimuli a certain way, whether you have ADD or not. So maybe women, because they're given less grace, have, it's like, nope, you just got to solve it. Like, you're not going to be excused to, you know.
It's always your fault. Like, right. No matter what the circumstances are, like, it's always your fault. And we're conditioned to believe it's our fault. Even when other people are failing around us, we're conditioned to believe, I should have been able to fix this. I should have known what to do to fix this. You know, that sort of thing. So I think that that's where I was. Like, the fact that she was a people pleaser. I went through... And it's really hard for people who are in my life now because I'm like, no, period.
They're like, excuse me?
Excuse me? You never say no. So, and it's been years that I've been doing this, and it's still really hard for me to put up those boundaries. But I used to be like, whenever someone asked me to do something, I'd find a way to do it. Even if I knew I didn't have any space to do it, I would find a way to do it. I was always overextending myself for family, for friends, for my kids, from a fucking dog, like literally. It's like, no, I committed to taking this dog for a 2-hour walk every day. I'm doing this. You know what I mean? Like, there was always someone else to please. And then I would get to the point where you're like, okay, well, what makes you happy? What are you supposed to be doing for yourself? And I'm like, I don't know. I guess pleasing these people. And then the whole fucking cycle starts all over again. You know what I mean? I spent like 5 or 6 years just doing that and then got so burnt out to the point where I was literally hiding in my closet. Like, I would be in my closet just to go in my closet and cry. Like, yeah. I could hear people looking for me, just like, I'm just going to go in the closet and cry and then come out and be like, I'm fine.
Yeah.
What do you need? You know what I mean? Did that for years. And then getting diagnosed, it was like, huh, I don't have to do this. It's like,
what a relief. Yeah.
People will figure things out on their own, you know? And that was the main thing. It's like, if I don't do it, like when my mom calls and asks me for something, or if my sister needs me to rescue her from something, or if my husband needs me to stop what I'm doing and go do these tasks, who's going to do it if I don't, you know? Like, who's going to do it? Like, obviously they needed help. They can't do it on their own. They asked me. So who's going to do it if I don't? And then there was guilt. That was the other thing. When you do start saying no and putting up boundaries, it's not like, oh, you said no, and you walk away like, oh, I feel great. No, you feel horrible. You feel guilty.
Right.
Because you're like, okay, maybe I should have tried to make space. Maybe I should have done that extra thing more. And getting out of that headspace has been really difficult too.
This is really resonating with me. Because I was looking for the quote, because Portia, obviously, she's kind of exploring this throughout the novel. You know, there's this one quote, she was selfish and didn't think of others. She was always trying to figure out how to please people.
Oh, when Johan told her that she was a people pleaser.
Yeah. And
she
was always running low-level scans, making sure there was nothing for her to do. It was exhausting now that she had put her finger on it. Now that Johan had, rather. And
That, yeah, goosebumps, right? Like when I read that the first time, I was like, as a matter of fact, me and my friend, I have a close friend, the one that I was telling you about that got diagnosed, we have like a lot of the same upbringing. Like there's alcoholism in our family. And she was like, you know, we're always really in tune with each other when we go out. You know what I mean? Because like we could be networking somewhere and our thing is like, let's not just stick together. Let's just walk around and talk to people and mingle or whatever. But I could look across the room and see her face and know that she's done. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And she could do the same thing for me. And she was like, I was talking to my therapist and she said that that is like a symptom of coming up in an alcoholic home, because you're always doing these low level scans to see, has this person been drinking? Was there a fight that occurred before I got here? Is there a fight brewing now? Is this the temperature where I can ask for things? Which it never is. You never can ask for things. You know, like you come in the room and you're just kind of like, your antenna are up, like emotionally. And I think like when people talk about like whether or not you're empath or whatever, I don't know how much of that is nature versus nurture, but I feel like I still do that. Like always. Just kind of like, what's going on in this room? And that was very familiar to me. This is why that to me is more of a reason why I'm an introvert than, you know, I need to be at home. It's more like I go out and I'm constantly doing those low level scans. So by the time I leave, I'm exhausted. Like I ran a marathon.
Right. No. I feel that completely. And I think like, I'm so sorry, every extrovert who's listening to this right now. But I feel like when extroverts are feeding off of the environment, I mean, it's because they're taking more than they're giving?
Yes. I think they think you're giving a lot, but they're not.
I remember I had this friend who like, we're not really friends anymore for reasons that will become clear, but we went to high school together and we went to college in the same city, and she'd like invite me over and I'd go over to her dorm and I'd think it's just the two of us are going to hang out, but there was always like a whole group of people and I'd be like, what the, like, I just want to talk to you. I don't want to like mingle with like 10 of your other friends who don't give a crap about me and I don't give a crap about them. But it was always like, well, I'm creating a party. I think that what she needed was she like could never be alone with her own thoughts and she just always needed to be surrounded with people, but like didn't ever actually want to have a real conversation. She just wanted to be like the center of attention.
Yep.
And I got real tired of that real fast because I was like,
I've known people like that, and I think that those kind of extroverts, which those are different, they're vampires.
Energy vampires. Do you watch What We Do in the Shadows?
Yes.
That is too spot on.
Yes. And those type of people are different than people who are just people who come in the room and like suck all the air out. You know, like that some extroverts just come in the room and like everyone is looking at them in the room. But energy vampires are different. Like they need the stimulus around them and they only pull in. They never give back. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I've had friends like that. And now I look back at those, like, that was a very one-sided friendship. And my mother used to tell me these things. I was like, that girl is not your friend.
Mm.
I'm like, what do you mean? It's just like, you're always going to her house. You're always doing things with her. You're always initiating things. And then when she comes over, she's just kind of bulldozing over everything you want to do. And you're like, yeah, okay, yeah, okay. You become this timid, dumb thing. And then she leaves and you're upset. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, she's my friend.
But what,
think, you know what I mean?
But what is a friend? Like, right?
What is a friend?
That made me think, one of the things I talked about in therapy was, my therapist. In one conversation we got into, I was saying something like, I feel like I'm supposed to understand that people will love me regardless of what I do for them, but I just can't actually imagine it. I'm like crying. I'm like, I feel like this is just something I just can't understand, you know?
That feels familiar too. Because like our love language, I guess, is like acts of service.
Mm.
Is that right? So like if when someone does something for you, that feels like love, right? So
yeah.
You're thinking, this is how I express my love to everyone, like acts of service. Like I'm doing all these things for you. So you must know that I love you, but you're not getting the same type of love back. You know,
mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of times we choose friends in weird ways. I'm 42 years old. I feel like I finally have a group of friends that these friends are actually like my real friends, not like friends that there's some transactional thing going on or friends where, you know, I only do this one particular thing with them and nothing else. So I think that it just takes time. And I think a lot of times, too, is romanticized. Like, you know, if you've been friends with someone since you were five, you have to remain friends with them forever. Like, you always have to work it out. Like, that's not a friend anymore. That's family. That's bullshit. And I had to have, like, a big friend breakup before I realized that it was bullshit. Like, I stepped back. This was one of the people that my mom was like, that girl was never your friend. I was like, what?
Why didn't you tell me this earlier?
No, she told me.
Oh, okay.
She could not stand this girl. And she was like, I don't know why you keep having that girl around. She's not your friend. But yeah, like it's definitely a process. Like, and then too, like for me with ADD, like I always felt like I was the flaky friend. Like I wasn't a great friend. Sometimes it was like, yeah, I'll definitely go and do this with you. And I'm like, nope, I can't.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. then, or just showing up and being moody or because I didn't want to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And that would challenge my friendships. It was like, well, you act like you don't want to be here. I'm like, I am here and I don't want to be here.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you see it on my t-shirt?
Yeah.
Like you
said you wanted me to be here. You didn't say you wanted me to enjoy being here.
That part. I'm here.
Yeah. I feel like this is, to bring it back to the book, this is like Portia's thing, right? She's hypervigilant about other people's needs. You know, like you were talking about, she thinks everything is her fault. If something failed, it's because she wasn't working hard enough. She wasn't aware of the need that needed to be attended to. And she doesn't think that she sort of has that inherent value and that she needs to constantly be proving over and over again and again, like that she has a right to be there. With Tavish, he's like, wow, she's so competent that he kind of can't understand why
she doesn't get that she's, yeah, like he's
right.
That's definitely like a miscommunication there. Like they are just not speaking the same language at all. Like he's like, she's so competent, she's doing everything. How could she think that she's not good at life? You
mm-hmm.
know what I mean? Portia's into the spectrum. I totally understand it. Like it was recognizable. It was easy. I'm like, of course, because she's not like, you don't just make one mistake. Like you're holding on, you're dragging all of those bags with you every fucking time you go to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you come into it optimistically, you're already waiting for it to fail. And I think that's how she approached, like even in the very first chapter,
mm-hmm.
she's convincing herself, no, this is not going to fail. But she's already set her mind to this failing. So it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, I'm not going to be good at this. This is probably going to be just like all the other shit that I did. I'm going to fuck this up too. And the closer we got to the climax of the story, the more she kept saying, I'm going to fuck this up. I'm going to fuck this up. I'm going to fuck it. Oh, I fucked it up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like.
Right. And he's like, no, so, I'm just protecting her, you know. And she's like, I fucked it up. And he's like, okay, I've saved her now. Now that she's gone, it's for the best.
Mm-hmm.
And like, he just doesn't get it.
She doesn't get it.
Did you think that, like, I hated Portia's parents, and I kind of wanted there to be more of, like, a reckoning with them. Do you think that her conflict with her parents was more in her head than real?
No. I think that there was definitely some coded language going on between her parents and her. And I think the underlying thing is that, and I think Alyssa explores this a little bit in Reggie's book, in her novella, but that when there's a disabled child in the house, there's a lot of attention put on them. And it's hard to frame this because I have a disabled child. And I'm just kind of like, you know, it's hard not to center everything around this one person, because if this person isn't functioning, isn't able to function without help, like, we all have to help. We're all taking care of this person. So if all the attention is focused on them, and then they start to excel at things, you know what I mean? It's like, oh, like, her sister was physically disabled, but she was brainiac. She was, you know, creative and all of these things. And then it became a situation where they were talking to her like, oh, why can't you do this like Reggie? You don't have nearly as many shortcomings as she does. You should be doing twice as good, sort of thing, but not even considering that maybe she does have a disability as well. And yeah, do I think her parents were doing it intentionally or maliciously? No, but I do think that there needed to be a conversation had. It probably wouldn't have went well. Mine didn't go well with my parents, but you know. So, you know, and I think too, like, a transition from adulthood, from being your parents' child into adulthood, that conversation needs to happen. Like, you can't keep talking to me like this. You know, like, I'm not my failures. And these are the things that you're doing and saying to me that's making me perpetuate this behavior. Like, well, not making me, or making me feel like I have no choice but to live up to this very low standard. Like, the bar is on the floor and you're not asking me to raise it at all. But yeah, I did dislike her parents because they seemed really detached. Like, they weren't checked in with her at all.
They didn't seem to acknowledge that she had emotional needs, or that she would notice when they acted like she had no value other than as kind of
a pretty face,
a pretty girl. Yeah, I think the thing that they, so they like offer her a job, but then give the job to somebody else.
Some random, like, this is the thing. It's like, the way that that went down really irritated me, because it was obvious that they didn't really want her to take the job. It was like, maybe we should offer it to Portia because
she's so shiftless. You know, she needs,
yeah, maybe we need to guidance. Give her some structure, some guidance. Maybe having her in the office will, you know, put her on the straight and narrow. We should offer it to her. But they never wanted her to take it in the first place. So it was like this pretense that was going on, and she knew it was there. Like, they didn't really want her to take the job.
It's like they didn't want her to, but then they also guilted her for not being more excited about it. It was so frustrating.
Yeah, the parents were frustrating. But that interaction doesn't feel uncommon. Like, it feels like parents just expect you to be like little versions of themselves, like not have your own. Especially when you're wealthy, from what I hear. I don't know what this is. But when you're wealthy, they just kind of expect you, like, there's a family business. You're going to work in the family business. And I'm like, oh, I didn't have any other aspirations of my own. But that's fine. I'm going to work in the family business. And it's kind of like that whole, no one's discussing these things. They're just things that are supposed to happen. And Portia, labeled as the fuck up, is just bouncing around doing whatever she wants to do, which is typical of someone her age.
Yeah. Well, and I think that this is, like, my expectation as the reader, where I'm like, I want to see this tied up with a neat bow. Or, like, I wanted her to confront or, like, stand up to her parents in some way. But I think that this is one of the places where this book is not falling into the fantasy of resolution with this issue. It's presenting it like, well, you know what? Portia figured out a lot of stuff, and she's probably going to be dealing with her family and
forever.
I mean hopefully for a long time, you know.
I mean, like, this is a thing. You can grow up and have all the realizations you want, but your parents are already old when you're an adult. You know what I mean? Like, they're set in their ways, and you can say, these are my boundaries, these are this. So even one confrontation in the book wouldn't have been enough, because then it would have been too neat. You know what I mean? It would be like, oh, she talked to her parents about her problems, and now, yay, everyone's happy. But that's not true.
Yeah.
Even though I know it's romance, it's supposed to be fantasy, but
I mean, right. And I think that it's just like, you know, Chekhov's gun, you know.
Chekhov's gun, yeah. Like, you put the gun on the wall, you got to fire it by, yeah.
Right. I mean, and I think that just like as readers, there is this expectation like, well, you created a conflict. Now you need to resolve this conflict before the end of the story. But
But I'm going to argue that that conflict wasn't really with her parents. It was more with herself.
I mean,
she didn't really need it. I mean, that conflict that you were reading as external conflict is really internal conflict. Because every conversation that was going on with them, she was the one, the story she was telling herself was different than what she was receiving, what they were giving. Yes, there was coded language in there, but it's how she's hearing it. And that's what's creating the conflict. And that's inner conflict, not outer conflict.
I mean, I'm not going to argue with you because that's exactly what it is. Yeah.
So it was solved. It was solved. It just, she didn't solve the extraneous conflict with her family. But I mean, those scenes, those phone calls were about her inner conflict, not about her relationship with her parents.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. No, I'm like, I'm just going to edit that whole part out so that, no, I'm just kidding. But
I mean, this is what I do. I do this.
This is what I do.
I read books. I do it. This is what I do.
Did you know Shelf Love has an email newsletter? Get episode extras like book recommendations from guests, additional editorializing on topics discussed on the podcast, automatic entry into giveaways, heads up on opportunities to participate in the podcast, plus I share links that further the discourse. The episode extra you'll get from today's conversation is a book recommendation from Tasha. What will it be? You can sign up on shelflovepodcast.com or via the link in the show notes.
I feel like Alyssa has been fairly explicit about, like, I want to write a royalty series that subverts a lot of what we understand to be royalty tropes. Mm. And so I think this book, there's sort of like this fantasy of royalty of being saved, right? Like the Cinderella story, like Cinderella was rescued, right, out of poverty by the white prince, the poor white girl. Rescued by the rich white guy.
The rich white guy, yeah.
With power. And I feel like Alyssa, as I know she is an intentional writer, made intentional choices about, in many ways, Portia saves him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, and she is like a rich black woman. Like, mm-hmm. She has a lot of financial privilege. Although she does have to reference Debrett's quite a bit, she herself is much more comfortable in this world than that he's moving into.
And I do think that the way that she's handling it is very compelling as well. It's like, these aren't what we typically consider dukes to be, you know, like, this guy's not a duke. He's just a regular guy, even though, like, he makes swords. I don't know how regular that is.
I mean, and he's, like, super hot and, like...
I mean, I feel like the guys on Forged in Fire are not this hot. But, you know, like, the whole idea that she comes in and he automatically... pins her is like, oh, this rich, spoiled American, you know. And when the tables turn, she's the one who has to kind of rescue him because he's thinking to himself, like, oh, God, I'm going to have to take care of this little brat. She's going to be, you know, falling into things or breaking things or doing whatever spoiled rich people do abroad.
Mm-hmm. She's going to worry about breaking a nail when they're going to make swords.
Oh, I can't get my clothes dirty or that sort of thing. He just thought she was going to be very precious, and she wasn't. Which I enjoyed. Like, even though she was wearing precious clothing, she was like, no, I'm going to do this sword fighting workout in my silk shirt, mm-hmm. you know? And then in the end, where the tables turned and he ended up being vulnerable, you know, because he was going into a world where he was unfamiliar, uncomfortable, and he didn't want to do it. Like, he had no interest in doing it. That was the major part. It's like there was so much resistance there. He's like, I'm only going to learn as much as I need to so I can get this done, sort of thing. But when, you know, like, the bigger things came around, like, he was looking to her. Like Johan said, he's like, you can't keep leaning on this walking stick. Mm-hmm. Like, every walking stick has, like, you know, a maximum amount of pressure it can take. And you're a big man and you're leaning on her. Johan was like the wise old friend in this. Like, he
was the fairy godmother.
He was like, excuse me, sir, why are you so smart? And then proceeds to be super messy in his own book. but yeah, like, just the way he came in and was like, you know, there's some codependency happening here. And like, to have it pointed out that way by like an outside observer And then to see how Tavish responds to it, instead of him being like, oh, I'm going to start taking care of myself more, he just gets grumpy again. You know what I mean? Right. Like, that's not really helpful. He gets grumpy because obviously she's getting the same conversation from Johan, and she's like, well, I'm going to let you swing. It's time for you to go do it yourself. And he's like, well, I don't want to do it myself.
Mm-hmm. Right. I do think that his story is, it's the story of privilege, right? Like, mm-hmm. like I have to go learn how to dance and like learn which fork to use. And it's like, oh my God. And then you inherit all of this money. You have all this power. Like, please spare us.
Cry me a river. Like, exactly. Go over there and figure out which one of those forks is the oyster fork.
Mm-hmm. Well, and
which I didn't even know there was a fork for oysters.
I mean, right. And honestly, at the end of the day, I mean, like, yes, maybe he did have to learn that stuff. Maybe also, like, he could be like, well, I can kind of take the power and the privilege without learning that part. You know, there's obviously, Johan is like a really interesting case study for ways that you can kind of use things to your own ends.
Yes.
And I'm so glad that by the end of this book, Tavish had realized how he could use this power and privilege in a way that benefited the people and the causes that he cared about and remained true to himself in this new role. But I feel like there is just this like universal lesson of like every time you find yourself being like, oh, all these things I can't change that I'm whining about. It's like, but what can you do? Like,
what can you
rethink this, you know, maybe like pause, look at it from another angle.
Exactly. Then I think what really gets lost too, especially when you're talking about historical romance, is like these dukes don't really have jobs. It's mm-hmm. just a billionaire story, but historical. And this, the way she did it, is not. Yes, it's a billionaire story, but it's not. You know what I mean? He's getting rescued out of his poverty, which was barely poverty. Mm-hmm. He could have sold his shit and moved into a smaller place and probably done some other things. Mm-hmm. Like, he was stubborn.
He could have been a little bit less of a victim.
A little bit less. So,
like, oh no, I inherited this big building.
This big rambly building. I don't know what to do. Oh, I rented it out to my mates. And then they all went off. And then I got married. And now I have this debt. Like,
yeah.
You could sell it. Like, even in the story, people were calling him to sell it. I'm like, bro, sell it.
Yeah. Like, he's like, well, I don't know. I don't want to.
Like, what are you holding on to it for? It's like, who gave you this? It's like some inheritance for some person you didn't even know. Like, why do you care?
I feel like he didn't have enough questions about how this came to be. Also, like,
that whole part about his mom, and like, I enjoyed the part where when she picked up the phone, like, he was just gonna ask her some questions. He picked up the phone and all he could say was the man's name. Mm-hmm. But I was upset that his mom wasn't like more, I don't know, not even ashamed, but just kind of repentant.
Like, oh, sorry, I didn't tell you this. Very yeah, important.
She's just kind of like, nah, I was in love. It didn't work out. Da, 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 da. You were born. Father wanted you, but now he's dead. I'm like, bro, you just told him his whole life story. And you're like, oh, but don't go be a duke.
Yeah.
His mom was annoying to me. I'm like, okay, yes, you had your thought. Days that happened, he was a thought. you got pregnant by a duke. I feel like you should have told him this. I feel like there was no reason to hide this from him. I don't understand.
Yeah, there were, yeah, you know,
that's some romance hand waving.
Yeah,
you know
what
I mean? Like, you just gotta be like, yeah, he didn't know. But I like, even her not telling him, I feel like she should have been more repentant. Like, she was just like, eh, this is what happened.
She should have had a little more guilt. Like, some people should have a lot less guilt. Some people should have more.
Yes. Mom should have had more. Like, I'm so sorry for keeping this from you. You don't have to repent about what happened. Just be like, I'm so sorry I kept this from you.
Mm-hmm.
And also, now your father's dead, so you can't even get any.
You have no relationship with him. Sorry.
No hope of one.
Yep. It's over. I really like, though, that by the end, at least, he has learned how to make his situation work for him. And I feel like so often we look at the shit sandwich that has been handed us and we pretend like we have to eat it and that our only choice is eat the shit sandwich or don't eat the shit sandwich.
You could add something to the shit sandwich to make it taste better.
Exactly. Or make a new sandwich. Like, or deconstruct, take out the shit.
Take out the shit. You can put something else in there, some other meat product.
Exactly. Exactly. Even if there is a faint taste of shit, it's better than eating a shit sandwich.
Right. And I don't even think that he really had a shit sandwich, let's be honest. Like, maybe he just had a smear of shit on top of the bread, like one slice of bread.
You know? He just had a slightly stale piece of bread in his sandwich.
Yeah, maybe the meat was a little funky. But, you know, it was like one day before it was going bad. But he there wasn't really a lot of work, mental gymnastics to do it for him to get there. And I think what made his character solid was that he always was going to do it. Like, there was no real wavering in that direction. Like, he would rather have quit the dukedom than be compromised in that way. But I think a lot of times in these stories, like, we just accept that, you know, like, oh, God, the hero might have to do something. He'll be an awful person for that. I think Portia fulfilled that role, like her getting drunk, quote unquote, at the ball. And just being the awful person, like doing the unforgivable thing. Mm-hmm. And he didn't really do anything wrong. He was actually kind of perfect, which was...
Ugh. I mean, I don't think it was... It wasn't his... I mean, there was a little bit of a journey, but it also kind of like wasn't his journey. And he's really just there. He only needs to be compelling enough for us to want Portia to get together with him.
Basically.
It's most romance novels. You're just like, I mean, sometimes you just choose who to focus on.
Which is why I always find it really, really find it interesting that most readers are like so falling all of themselves for the heroes. I'm like, he's really just a prop for the heroine. Like, what are y'all missing?
Yeah. Well, and right. Like, so like as a cishet woman, like I'm primarily here for the ladies.
Yeah.
You know?
I unabashedly am a lover of heroines. The heroes can be whatever, really. Yeah. I mean, they just have to not be horrible people. That's it. Like, bare metal.
Well, and I
just don't murder kittens or like.
Right.
You know.
Right.
That's it. The bar is on the floor, or as Katrina says, the bar is in hell. So all we have to do is step over that.
Yeah.
Like, expectations are low. So I always find it really interesting when people are like, oh, I love this hero, this boyfriend material. I'm like,
I mean,
okay.
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 Like, I'm just going to say, the book is really funny. There's a lot of really cool things with, like, talking about social media. And, like, it's very now.
It feels
very current.
And I like that about it, too. Because people, even though that we had, like, super lift instead of lift. And
there's like an Instagram knockoff. Yeah. Instaface.
And I wonder, like, did the publisher say you had to do that? Because I feel like at this point, like, these things are such integral parts of our lives. Like, it's kind of like, we know what this is. Can we just say what this is? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like how Ziploc is what we call storage bags. Windex is what we call window cleaner.
Yeah, Kleenex. Yeah, come on.
Kleenex is a tissue. Like, these things have become, these brands are now the thing.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. People ask me questions about that all the time. I'm like, look, as far as I'm concerned, ain't nobody getting sued for this, so keep it in there.
I mean, look, I'm not a lawyer. I will not pretend to be a lawyer and understand what the issue is, so.
Facebook is not suing you for using Facebook in a book.
Right, you're promoting
that. That was very meta. Facebook is not going to sue you for using Facebook in a book. But yeah, I thought, like, yeah, there were lots of laugh out loud moments. And there were like a couple of times, like, I remember when I was reading it the first time, the section where he puts his hand on her neck. And I was like, oh my God, is Alyssa about to put a choking stroke in this book? I was like, no! I was like, in an Avon book? And I got in her DMs after that. She was like, I did. I was like, they're choking in this book. What?
I remember that. Well, and here's my favorite funny line, or at least one I can find quickly. He smelled, it was a good smell, but still, if she was a man's sweat sommelier, sommelier, she would say it had hints of steel, citrus, and essence of Tavish. I think there's a Twitter account now of somebody, it's like the way men smell.
Smells like romance men smells or something like yeah. That was toying with the idea. Like, she was being cheeky about the idea, but mm-hmm. also like a brilliant description.
Yeah. Right. And it's accurate. Like, why he should, of course, smell like steel. It's much better than the heroes who smell like horses and tobacco.
Unsmoked tobacco smells good. Smoked tobacco smells like smoke.
and then layer in horse.
No. But since someone on Twitter was saying that the way that we associate horse smell is with like horse stable smell. And
which
that might
poop.
Be true. Yeah, we're smelling horse shit, not like actual horses. And she was like, horses just smell like horses. Like kind of clean and animally, but not funky.
But
and I'm like, I'm sorry, my nose can't separate those smells anymore. And like, I used to ride when I was little. So like that smell, I know what a horse smells like, but also I just, in my nose memory, my olfactory memory mm-hmm. is horse shit.
I don't know what a horse smells like, but I know what a dog smells like.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I don't enjoy dog smell. You know what I mean? Like
I have a dog and I don't enjoy his, especially after he's been out and active all day.
Yeah.
Like, which is what they're associating this horse smell with, right? Like
yeah.
the horse has been running and the man has been on the horse and he smells
they're all
like
lathered the- up. Like, ugh.
It smells like funk.
Yeah. It smells like go take a shower, please.
Yes. Yeah.
Everybody get the horse in there.
Just spray it all.
Did you have any other things you wanted to say about this book? I think we've said everything, but...
I think we've said everything, yeah.
Okay.
I love this book.
This was my first time reading. I now measure things, because I have this physical book, I measure books in how many Dukes by default they are. So, like, I was reading... I looked up, like, how many Kindle pages this book is. It's, like, 600-something. And I was like, okay, like, I can eye this book... And then I was reading another book that was like 300 Kindle pages, and I was like, oh, it's like half a Duke by default. It is literally the standard by which I measure all other books.
That's fair.
So, Tasha, thank you for joining me today. How can listeners find you, and what is coming next from Tasha L. Harrison?
Well, you can find me and everything you want to know about me at TashaLHarrison.com. I am frequently on Twitter, as I... stated in this recording. I have a Twitter addiction problem. It's fine. And right now I'm working on a novella called Liquor and Laundry, and hopefully we'll publish it before the end of July. That's the goal. Not in the universe, so now I've said it out loud, so I have to do it now.
Yeah, perfect timing.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to episode 54, and thanks to Tasha for joining me. Also, FYI, Tasha's latest, Liquor and Laundry, is available now. She hit her goal! Yay! Here's what's in store in this spicy erotic novella. High school crush. Black romance. Jerked chicken wings. Steamy laundromat makeout sessions. And a dirty talking hero. Go grab it on Amazon. I'm thrilled to formally announce my collaboration with Copper Dog Books for Bookstore Romance Day, which will be on August 15th, 2020. The event will be completely virtual because of that pesky pandemic we're still in the midst of. Some people are acting like it's over, but it's not. But for my listeners, that probably works out well since you don't all live in the Boston area. For all the details, follow the link in the show notes. But the quick and dirty is that you can enter a giveaway right now to potentially win free romance novels. I know we have at least 6 books to give away, and Julie and Meg at Copper Dog are getting even more lined up, including books you can't even buy yet. I've also curated a list of romance for the special Bookstore Romance Day 2020 collection, and every book in there will be 20% off when ordered online between August 15th and August 23rd, 2020. My list is over 50% independently published romance, plus some traditionally published options. I've got books by Katrina Jackson, Jack Harbin, Alexis Daria, Olivia Waite, Alyssa Cole, naturally, and more. You can view the full list on Copper Dog Books' website. Don't forget, I will be doing an Ask Me Anything type episode with special guest Jen from the Monogamish podcast. If you have a question for me, send it over to Andrea@shelflovepodcast.com before August 15th, 2020. All the details for this episode can be found on shelflovepodcast.com, including a transcript. Look for episode 54. Nicole Falls is my next guest, and we talk about reviews, imposter syndrome, and I Think I Might Love You by Christina C. Jones. Thanks for joining me today. If you have any thoughts on the show, I'd love for you to reach out to me. You can send an email to andrea@shelflovepodcast.com. Black Lives Matter. Stay safe, stay mad, and keep reading romance.